I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie lent his considerable clout to a fundraiser for GOP presumptive presidential nominee Mitt Romney in Woodbridge last night. Christie endorsed Romney last fall, and his name is on a list of possible running mates, even though Christie has indicated that he doesn't want to play second fiddle if Romney wins the White House. He's got plenty on his plate in New Jersey, including a face-off with the democratically controlled legislature over the budget. Love him or hate him, you can't discount or ignore Governor Chris Christie and his headline-grabbing personality. Our guests Bob Engel and Michael Simons chart Christie's growing political prominence in their new book called Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power. Bob Engel is senior political columnist for Gannett, New Jersey newspapers, writes a syndicated column and a political blog called Politics Patrol. Bob Engel, nice to have you with us here in our Philadelphia studios.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us, Michael Simons, a reporter covering the New Jersey State House in Trenton for Gannett, and he writes a blog called Capital Quickies. And Michael Simons, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Bob, I know that you both interviewed Chris Christie. Is he the same way off mic that he is on mic? And by that I mean, is his personality the same when you interview him quietly in an office somewhere?
I think it is. Of course, he has his moments when he will get on a roll and he can have you rolling in the floor laughing.
Really?
There are other times he can very, very serious, and there are times that he really gets upset with something that's happened, and he expresses that too. What you see in the news conferences are all aspects of his personality that you can see in private as well. It's not phony. It's all him, but he's like all the rest of us. We have these different aspects of our personality.
Sounds like you had largely unfettered access to him and also to people that know him, family.
We did. When St. Martin's Press asked us to do this, I went to him and I had a one-on-one conversation with him. And I've been covering him for a long time, so he and I know each other. And I said, look, I can write this book with or without you, but it'll be a much better book if I'm working with you. And he said, what do you need? And I said, I need to talk to you. I need to talk to your wife. I need to talk to your family. I need to talk to your friends, and I need to talk to your colleagues. I just need for you to make a phone call in case I get to somebody who won't talk to me.
Hmm.
And he says, okay. And he did. He kept his word.
So what's it like to cover him as a reporter, Michael?
It's a roller coaster.
Yes.
You know, you could go to press conferences for other governors, and you kind of knew what was going to be said. Even if it was a major event, it wouldn't always turn out to be news. With Christie, you know, he's going to read books to kids, and you don't want to miss that one because you're not sure what he's going to say afterwards. So it's sort of different in that regard from past governors we had. He's sort of unpredictable in that way.
I always like to know a little bit about someone's biography and background. What's interesting is his family, Bob,
right.
And he comes from, I would say, as you write about it, an argumentative family. He had he had parents who seemed to love each other, but they seemed to bicker about most everything.
Well, that's right. When we first thought about what we were going to do in this book, we thought about a politician who started out at the local level and relatively soon, after having a roller coaster career, got to be in the governor's office. And then when we started looking into his family, it took a different turn. And if you go back a couple of generations before him on his mother's side of the family, they actually came from Italy on a ship, went by the Statue of Liberty, took whatever job they could get. It's the quintessential all-American story. And then in a couple of generations, you have a guy who is a very popular governor across the country, who a lot of people think should run for president. But as to your specific question about the parents, yeah, they were very close. They loved each other, but it was just a part of how they related to each other. They fought like cats and dogs. And I think that's a part of what you see in Christie, whereas he will fight with the legislature and certain people, but he doesn't see that the way some people see that.
He sees this as a kind of, this is what you do when you are relating to people or dealing with issues?
Yes, right. Yeah, yeah. I think that's a part of what's missing from people who don't know him. And one of the reasons we decided to do the book is in my travels is when somebody found out I was from New Jersey, they would say, oh, I love your governor, or do you know the governor? And then I would get in conversation with them and find out what they really know about him are those YouTube videos. And that they didn't really know him, but they liked what they saw. So we think, well, you know, why don't we give them the whole book so they'll know who this guy is?
Well, what's interesting, Michael, is that even in first, second grade, he seemed to have political aspirations as a high schooler, seemed to be interested in politics as well.
Right. Yeah. It's second grade. You know, he's standing at a flagpole and tells his teacher that one day he's going to be president. He's 10 years old. He asked what he wants for Christmas. He said, "Oh, I want a law book." You know, so, you know, I didn't ask for a law book when I was 10.
No, he's me neither.
He's 14 years old. And Tom Kane, then a candidate running for governor, he was in the assembly at the time, comes and speaks at his school, and he decides now is when I'm getting involved in politics. His mom drives him to Tom Kane's house, gets to the driveway and says, "Well, you're taking it from here. Do you want to do this? You walk up to the front door and talk to him."
And knock on the door.
Right, knocks on the door, says, "I want to get involved in politics." And, you know, you think about this, this would never, ever happen now. You probably couldn't even get to the front door.
Right.
But, and then Kane brings him up to Bergen County that night for an event to help, like, put literature on the chairs and things. He stands in the back and watches. So he's 14. He's already getting involved in politics. And so, yeah, this started back in the 60s and 70s.
You mentioned his mother, and she seemed like perhaps the more fierce of the parents. Would that be a fair description, Michael?
Yeah, the way that the governor puts it, which is a pretty funny line, is that in the car of life, his mom was driving the car, his dad is a passenger in the car of life. Not to say his dad doesn't have a forceful personality of his own. He does. You know, we got to meet with him. He can tell some great stories, some funny stories, you know, gets choked up telling stories. So, you know, he's an active passenger. His mom was in charge, so to speak.
Go ahead, Bob.
One of the things about Christy that I think illustrates him was when we asked him about Kane and what was that spark that made you want to be in politics and go up to this guy's door. And he said, "Well, Bob," he says, "tell you the truth, I don't remember what he said." He says, "I could make up a story, but it wouldn't be the truth." Now, he could have right there. He could have made up, but he just told the truth. So I thought that was an interesting side of his personality.
Well, he became a freeholder, and I have to say, for those of us that don't live in New Jersey, I don't really know what that means.
Or freeloaders, as some people call them.
Yeah, I don't. What is a freeholder?
They're basically county, and I don't know what they call them in Pennsylvania, but they're like county commissioners.
Yeah,
they're
have
like
those
county elected officials, and for whatever reason, they call them freeholders over in New Jersey. I think it goes back to the Revolution, and I think the people had to be, you know, free and own land or something like that.
But this was an office that he held for a while.
One term, actually.
One term, exactly.
One term, and then in the primary for re-election, he was defeated by Republicans. That's why we have, there's a chapter in the book called Run Out by Republicans. They really worked at defeating him, and they thought that they had heard the last of Chris Christie. They had killed him politically and buried him.
And why didn't they want him to run for re-election, Michael?
The same reason why they didn't want him to run for the first office he ran for. And he sort of barged into politics at uninvited. He tried to run for state senate when there was already a Republican state senator. He ran for freeholder when there was already an incumbent freeholder. He was in office for a month. He decided he was going to run for assembly, even though the party
ambitious
had other candidates
fellow,
they
yes.
want to run. Yeah, ambitious to a fault, in a sense, within the party. There were folks who didn't like that ambition. They didn't like the way that he conducted himself on the board, basically, you know, calling them out for the way that money was spent, pushing ethics reforms that, you know, this is an all-Republican county that felt that they were doing a pretty good job running the county. They felt that voters thought they were doing a lousy job.
And who was
they
this interloper, right?
Right, yeah. They kept getting reelected, and therefore they, you know, took that as a sign that everything was fine and you're pushing too hard and you're rocking the boat. So he served for his one term. He was party to a couple lawsuits in either direction over campaign advertising content and other things related to some local disputes up there. So the party was very eager to rid itself of that headache and did. He finished last in the primary when he ran for nomination for a second term.
But what's interesting too, and perhaps this says more about the Republican Party than Chris Christie, but he was for gun control.
Yes.
He donated to Planned Parenthood.
Yes.
Which tells you perhaps, I don't know how he feels about that today, but it tells us a little something about where he stood back then.
Right. Well, on Planned Parenthood, he's definitely reversed course on that. One of the ongoing fights in Trenton, and it's going on again now, is about Democrats attempting to restore funds for such family planning services, and he trying to block them from doing that. On gun control, even when he was running for governor, on an interview with Sean Hannity on Fox News, of all places, he was basically defending gun control, his position on that, and saying, you know, essentially, New Jersey is different from other places. We need the laws we have on the books now. I'm not looking to expand them, but I think the laws that we have now we need to enforce. So he hasn't changed his position on that, and should he ever run for national office, I'm sure that will be explored at great length in a Republican primary.
Indeed. He did spend some time, Bob, working as a lobbyist, a securities lawyer for a law firm.
He did. His law firm started a lobbying arm, and a fellow named Bill Palatucci, who has been a friend of his, going way back. In fact, most people think Palatucci brought Christie into the law firm. It was actually the other way around. He brought him in, and so they started this lobbying arm. And when asked about that now, Palatucci usually says, well, Palatucci did 99% of the lobbying, and Christie came along and was in the room or whatever, but he didn't personally do much lobbying.
I wish the audience could see your face when you said that, Bob.
Well, I'm just telling you, that's what he said. I wasn't there, so I don't know, but I'm just saying that when it comes up now, that's the story.
Well, and what people should know, one of the biggest, their biggest clients was the University of Phoenix, and that's the for-profit university.
Right.
So they were, what, lobbying for the University of Phoenix?
Yeah, that school was attempting to create a campus in New Jersey around that time. It was an ongoing multi-year thing. So that was their they had multiple clients. That was the one that sort of made up the bulk of their whatever you call it, revenues, I guess.
Can we say that Chris Christie made a lot of money as a lawyer?
Well, Bob? I didn't look at his tax returns. I don't think he's a poor man by any means. Although, as we say in the book, he decided not to live in the stately governor's mansion. He decided to live in the slightly less stately Christie home in Mendham, it's a very nice home. And his wife works on Wall Street. She does very well. He pulls it off nicely because people can relate to him who are nowhere near his status, but he can relate to people at all levels. So I think you would have to conclude from everything that you see that, yes, he's been very successful.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're almost up in a break here. I want to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation talking about the rise of Chris Christie. And our guests are Bob Engel and Michael Simons, and they have co-authored a new book called Simply Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power. We're talking a bit about Christie's childhood, his political ambitions, which were clearly on display when he was even in elementary school. And we'll be talking more about his role as a U.S. attorney and then, of course, his rise to governor of New Jersey and all the back and forth about whether he will be a vice president or not. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Greensgrow Farm supports WHYY. The Greensgrow Camden Mobile Markets are open Thursdays and Fridays in 8 Camden neighborhood locations. Full details at greensgrow.org/Camden.
Sometimes you pay dearly for experiences that don't last long, and somewhere down the road, you may forget about them altogether. By comparison, think of the laughs, tears, and driveway moments you experienced this past year on WHYY. These stories have the power to stay with you for days, weeks, or a lifetime. The clock is ticking towards the end of our fiscal year this Saturday night. You still have time to support the memorable programming on WHYY. Visit WHYY.org.
This week on This American Life, if you want to see how China is changing, one place you can go, a parking garage.
Is that a Bentley?
This is a Rolls.
Right.
And then there's the vehicle that this American drives.
It's a bicycle.
It's more of a scooter.
It's an electric scooter.
I mean, I remember a time when to be a foreigner here was to be assumed wealthy.
Not anymore. What it's like now to be an American in China, this week
tonight at 9 on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by Choose PA Wind, an initiative designed to help local businesses and homeowners to understand clean, Pennsylvania-sourced wind energy. More information on using wind energy to power homes and businesses at choosepawind.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Michael Simons. He's a reporter who covers the New Jersey State House in Trenton for Gannett. Also has a blog covering New Jersey politics called Capital Quickies. Also with us, Bob Engel, senior political columnist for Gannett, New Jersey newspapers. And his column and political blog is called Politics Patrol. And they're co-authors of a new book called Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power. And we are, in a sense, marching through Chris Christie's personal and political life, getting us up to when he became the U.S. attorney. And Bob, perhaps I can turn back to you. He actually beat out Sam Alito for this particular job.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
That's right. Well, Bill Palatucci,
his friend,
had worked for the first President Bush and had gotten to know George W. Well, in fact, he had driven him around New Jersey when his dad was running for president. So Bush gets elected president, and Christie, who has written off politics, running for office, and he said, well, maybe I can find some other way to be of service. And after that whole thing up in his home county, in Morris County. So he got nominated for the U.S. Attorney's Office, and by gosh, he got the job.
Yeah.
Although he didn't have any background in criminal law, and that was made very clear by the people who thought he shouldn't be in the job.
Well, he raised money for George W. Bush. I guess
he
that
did.
Doesn't hurt.
No.
Karl Rove seemed to like Chris Christie.
Right, yeah, and the part about the fundraising is part of how Bill Palatucci had sort of helped resuscitate his political career. I mean, after Christie lost his Morris County seat, he still wanted to stay involved in politics, but didn't seem to have a future in elective politics at that point. But Palatucci at that was being approached by the George W. Bush people to sort of help set up a New Jersey organization, bring some influential people down to Texas for a meeting. And if you look at the list of people who flew down there, it was the Senate president, the Assembly speaker, influential senators, the Bergen County executive, and Chris Christie, who was a defeated one-term Morris County freeholder. So if you look at that list now, you'd say, wow, Christie went. At the time, he was sort of like the eighth wheel going along for that trip.
Who's Chris Christie?
Right. But
this was because of Bill Palatucci, right?
Right. And so the governor and Bill Palatucci and some other folks also raised money. You know, they weren't involved in managing the campaign. That was Governor Whitman's folks at the time who sort of took the political side. They did some of the fundraising, and certainly that helped when in 2001 they were trying to choose a U.S. attorney for New Jersey. You know, there were a bunch of names in the mix, and Christie sort of won an inside political campaign. In addition to having established relationships through that fundraising, they lined up letters of support from a lot of these political people, because it wasn't a open political campaign with a ballot, but it was essentially a successful political campaign and an inside game.
And he took the job September, 10th or 11th? The day before
the
September,
day before September 11th, right.
He got a phone call late that afternoon on the 10th saying that you're going to be nominated for this job. And then the entire contour of the job changed the next morning.
And George W. Bush always had nicknames for people. His nickname for Chris Christie, Big Boy.
Big Boy. That's right, Big Boy. He, there was a funny story about how after Christie was in the job, Bush came to New Jersey for something, and there was this long line of people waiting to greet the president when he got off of Air Force One, and right in the front was Jim McGreevy. So Jim McGreevy shakes hands with the president, and at the back, at the very back of the line, is Chris Christie, because he's way down low on the totem pole and all this. McGreevy runs behind the line and get beside Christie at the back. When the president gets there, he said, Mr. President, I'd like you to meet our new U.S. attorney. And Bush says, well, I know who he is. I nominated him.
Oh, wow.
What was he thinking, right?
Well, he did. He had a, sort of an incredible record, I guess, as U.S. attorney, but not uncontroversial. But still, how many convictions? Like 130 convictions or something, Michael?
Public corruption cases. Yeah, that was the number that they touted, was that they had 130 public corruption convictions. And he would concede also that some of those cases in the beginning were ones that had begun before he got there. But he saw them through to their completion and was very adept at getting maximum publicity for it. Right. But yeah, through the entire time that he was U.S. attorney, they didn't lose any of the public corruption cases that they brought. The final big investigation that had begun under his watch that was completed after he had left the office, they did wind up losing some of the cases in that. So that string has been broken, right. And some would say in part because he overextended that investigation. But at the time, and when he was running for governor, very usefully, they had a 130-0 record.
Well, and I mean, I do want to get to present day, but Bob, I mean, there were some certainly his critics about how we handled some of these cases, a terrorism case, a warrantless cell phone tracking.
Well, yeah, some people thought that that the whole federal government, of which he was a part at that time, and the Bush administration, of which he was a part at that time, went over the line, and I think maybe justifiably in some cases, including some of this. And of course, their response is, look, America is under attack. We had to do what we had to do to keep people safe.
Mm-hmm. And when and why did he want to become governor of New Jersey?
I think people, of course, let's go back to the second grade.
Right.
Maybe he saw that as a step en route to being president. I don't know. But when our prior book came out, The Soprano State, we noticed something right away, because at every book signing, people would say, do you think Chris Christie would make a good governor? And that was based on his U.S. attorney record. These are people who hadn't heard of him, really. Who pays attention to the U.S. attorney? Really, nobody does. So we saw something going on there, because that question came up again and again and again. And there was a time in there that it was U.S. Senate they wanted him to run for it, and he wasn't it? They said he didn't want to do that?
The U.S. Senate race in 2006, there were Republicans urging him to run. The governor's race in 2005, which was after Governor McGreevy's resignation, and that wound up being when John Corzine won election. But there were folks who were telling Christie at that time, look, the Democrats are in disarray, the public wants a new direction, now might be your only time to do it. But he had a job that he liked, and he thought about it, but he didn't really want to leave the job that he had. So, you know, unlike in 2008, when Barack Obama had won the presidency, it was clear that all the U.S. attorneys were going to be replaced.
Right.
He didn't really have a future in that at that time. In 2004, 2005, he didn't necessarily have to leave that job. He didn't know necessarily that there was a move afoot in Washington to possibly remove him when they were looking to dump some U.S. attorneys and they were looking at him.
But he was on the list.
He was on the list. But I don't think
two times.
Yeah, and he didn't quite know that when he was making decisions about whether to switch gears. But he liked the job that he had. He felt he could keep the job that he had and was continuing to make a difference. But it's sort of ironic when you think back to his Morris County days when he was running for offices that nobody wanted him to seek, that now he was declining to run for offices that people wanted him.
Right. But does that tell us something about his personality?
I guess it tells you that he learned something from the first time.
Right.
And you know, and he says that it didn't chasten him necessarily, but that he learned something from it, that there's, you know, that there's steps to take along the way, I guess, and patience is a virtue.
Yes, it is. I don't necessarily think of patience and Chris Christie in the same sentence, but the race for governor between Chris Christie and John Corzine, Bob, was a pretty nasty race.
It was ugly. It was really ugly. People were in a bad mood on both sides. It took a really, really bad turn when the whole issue of weight came up.
His weight.
Christie's weight. I can't recall, and I've been doing this too many years to remember, but I don't remember anything that's the equivalent of that. And there was an ad that was put out that showed him not in the most flattering way. And there was some mention made of throwing his weight around, that kind of thing. But I think it backfired, because I know that my mother, who lives in another state and can't vote for anybody here, nevertheless, because of the news coverage, knew about it. And she said, you know, there are a lot of people across the country who would like to lose weight and work very hard at it, and it's not easy. And I think they're going to resent this, and I think she was probably right. I think it backfired.
Do you think it helped him win the governorship?
I think he got some sympathy out of that from people who, you know, have struggled to stop smoking or lose weight or whatever it is that you're trying to do. It's not easy. And I think, and the way he handled it, sometimes he would be funny about it, and other times that he would be serious about it, and I think people could relate to that.
That's Bob Engel, who joins us along with Michael Simons, and we're talking about Chris Christie, New Jersey's headline-grabbing governor. Their book is called Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power, and that's exactly what we're talking about today in Radio Times, marching to the present tense and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michael, as we know, John Corzine was very much pro-union. Pro-public union. Chris Christie has been one of the more outspoken governors critical of public unions taking on teachers. Is this personal for him?
Well, I think it's in part personal because the unions had unloaded on him during the 2009 governor's race. You know, I don't think he necessarily has a personal animosity toward public workers, so to speak. But yeah,
but he has called them names, and
yeah, well, sure. Well, he's called everybody names. He's called me names, maybe not Bob, but yeah, yeah, as we said earlier, that's part of Christie.
His mother belonged to that union, by the way.
Well, I thought that was interesting. She was a member of the New Jersey Education Association.
She was. She worked in the school for a long time. Right. She wasn't a teacher, but she did belong to the union.
But certainly, I mean, a lot of the stuff that he says on union matters has been echoed in other states, and you've seen it in other places, and it sort of came in New Jersey first with Christie, so he gets some quote unquote credit for that, I suppose. But in part, that's a function of the way that New Jersey's governor's race happens a year before most other states. But yeah, I mean, on canceling transportation projects, which was another thing that he did famously, connecting North Jersey and New York, that then got repeated in Florida. I think in Wisconsin they canceled a major project. There were certain things that he sort of did first that then took off from there, in which he argues, and other people probably would too, that he was sort of a role model in a way for some of the conservative governors, including governors who are more conservative than him. You know, the governor of Florida, I think, overall is more conservative than Christie. Governor Walker in Wisconsin, you know, they passed a law that basically eliminated collective bargaining rights for public workers. New Jersey hasn't done that. You know, the big reform law that affected pensions and health benefits did take away health benefit collective bargaining, at least for that one cycle, which got people really angry. But it didn't eliminate collective bargaining totally. So while he's definitely done a lot of things that have gotten unions mad at him, and it's definitely part of his political persona, he also isn't quite as, for lack of a better way to put it, far out there as some other governors on that.
How do the people of New Jersey feel about their governor, Bob?
Well, we've had a couple of recent polls. The most recent, I believe it was something like, what, Mike, 55? 2%, something like that. And the one prior to that, which was a different polling organization, something like 57% approval rating. Since he's been in office now, what, for more than 2 years, I thought that was phenomenal, actually, because you usually, with a president or with a governor or anything, usually after they get in for a while, the enthusiasm dies down a little bit. But he seems to be doing okay in the polls.
And how do you understand when he says he doesn't want to be Mitt Romney, the presumptive GOP nominee, that he doesn't want to be Romney's running mate? Reading between the lines, deconstructing the use of language, where do you think he actually stands on
Well,
that?
There was a different story from president and vice president. When everybody was trying, and the people who were trying to get him to do that were some pretty heavy hitters, not only in the kind of people who fund campaigns, which is, you know, nowadays, unfortunately, that's what it's all about, how much money you can raise, but also people like Henry Kissinger, who had been there and done that and knew how things work. He was trying to get him to run as well, and some other influential people in politics. He said that he talked to the family, and the family just didn't want him to do it because it's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, 365-day-a-year. And he has a family, man. That's another part of him. He likes to get out and do things with his family. He didn't want to do it. Toward the end of it, though, his wife finally said to him, you've got to make a decision. He kept saying, no, 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 I don't want to do this. And they kept asking him, and not only reporters at every turn, and that was starting to be distracting of the other things he was trying to do, but also he was getting letters from people across the country who wanted him to. And his wife finally said to him, well, you know, look, we'll be okay. We, the family, we'll be okay. If you want to do this, you go ahead and do it. And he, now you tell me, he says, you know, this late game. But he's a young man. He's under 50. He's got plenty of time. Now, he changed his tune when it came to vice president. Because, once again, we in the media would say, okay, how do you feel about that? How do you feel about that? Yeah. And he would say, it would be presumptive of me to say no because I haven't been asked. Or he would say, well, you know, that Mitt Romney, he can be very persuasive. In other words, he left the door open on that.
Well, because he likes the attention and he likes being courted, do you think?
I think he does like the attention. I mean, wouldn't you if somebody was trying to get you to run for president or vice president? I would. I wouldn't want either job. But, I think I'd kind of like that. Yeah. I don't think he would be your traditional vice president. I think he would have to say to Mitt Romney or whoever, look, I don't want to cut ribbons and go to state funerals. That's not me. If I get into this job, I want to have something. I want to make a difference. I want to do something that counts. I think it would have to be like that.
Well, and you say a Biden-Christie vice presidential debate, Michael, would I think people might pay to watch.
Yeah, people might actually tune in for that particular one. But and Biden is sort of, but back in his U.S. Senate days, was sort of jokingly referred to as New Jersey's third senator and things. So we'd almost have two people in that.
but you got to imagine. I mean, the one thing you've got to say about the governor, whether you like him or you don't like him, he is fun to watch and he is fun to cover. And there are a lot of people, I think, should he be out there running, I think, who never cared about presidential politics, it would be tuning into debates and watching this coverage, who didn't before, because he's just entertaining.
Well, Mike, we have about a minute or so before our second break here, but I do want to take it up to present day, and there is a face-off showdown. I don't know. You know, there are many cliches I can use to describe what's going on right now between Governor Christie and the legislature over... He wants to give a decrease in taxes, cut taxes.
Right, yeah. He had originally proposed cutting everyone's income taxes 10%. The Democrats countered that by saying, well, why don't we give people a property tax credit off their income taxes? And revenues aren't where everybody wants them to be. People are worried that they're not going to get there. So Democrats say, well, why don't we wait 6 months for that? And whether it's for policy reasons or politics ones, right. Christie would like a tax cut much sooner than that.
Indeed. And but they're also saying that your revenue projections are very optimistic, and we want to see if those revenue projections come true or not.
Right. And after 2 years of being very conservative, aggressively conservative in managing money, there are folks who say, well, now you're going the opposite direction. Now you're being far too optimistic, and now conservative would be a good approach.
Well, including borrowing money as well, right?
Right. They're borrowing they're borrowing additional transportation money sooner rather than later so that they can free up some of that money to pay for other things in the budget.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And we do want to start taking some calls now that we've gotten, in a sense, up to the present tense, talking about Chris Christie with our guests Bob Engel and Michael Simons, co-authors of a new book called Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Gauguin, Cézanne, and Matisse, Visions of Arcadia, in which the masters and their contemporaries evoke the bliss of an earthly paradise on a monumental scale. Gauguin, Cézanne, Matisse, Visions of Arcadia is now on view at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Tickets are available at philamuseum.org or 215-235-SHOW. 215-235-SHOW.
On the next Fresh Air, why flying is no fun anymore and may be getting more dangerous. Aviation writer William McGee says airlines' cost-cutting hasn't just added fees and hassles. He says airplane maintenance is being outsourced to foreign companies where some workers can't read manuals for equipment they're working on. His book is Attention All Passengers. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll catch up with the Nuns on the Bus, Catholic Sisters on a 9-state, 28-city tour to draw attention to what the proposed congressional budget would mean for struggling families. Also, an environmental report card on the country's best and worst beaches. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Michael Simons and Bob Engel. Bob is a senior political columnist for Gannett, New Jersey newspapers. He has a syndicated column and a political blog called Politics Patrol. Michael Simons is a reporter who covers the New Jersey Statehouse in Trenton for Gannett, and he's got a blog covering New Jersey politics called Capital Quickies, and they have co-authored a new book simply called Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Rick from Hillsboro to join us on Radio Times. And Rick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I hate to break up the love fest, but I'm a professional firefighter in the state of New Jersey. And Governor Christie has misled the state and the rest of the country when it comes to pension reform. He's told everyone that it's our fault that our pension is not vested. And the real reason is two previous governors stole money out of our pension system, did not return it, and then the rest of these governors, including Christie, has told the municipalities who have to make a contribution, as I do to my pension, they don't have to make that contribution and haven't made one in 15 years and will not have to make one for the next 7 years. I now am required to pay 10% for my pension when previously I was paying 8.5%. And now the governor blames us, but he goes around to the rest of the country telling them this is a model that everybody should practice, that two governors should steal the money out of the coffers, not replace it, and then also let the municipalities not make their contribution and then blame the member.
Well,
how is that really a reform?
Well, no, fair enough, Rick, and let me give, I'll start with Michael Simons a chance to respond to his complaint, and I've heard this before, of course.
Yeah, well, I think it was actually more than two governors. I think it was four. I think it goes back to Governor Whitman and then straight through McGreevy, the one year for Cody, Corzine, including Christie. I mean, it's been a long time since full contributions were made to the pension fund. I don't think they were withdrawing money from the pension fund. They were preventing it from getting there in the first place. But that is a huge part of the problem. There's no doubt about that. And when Christie was running for governor, he had said he wouldn't touch pensions for current public employees. I think the way that he had phrased it as a candidate was that for future workers that there might be a different structure. But yeah, I mean, when he was a candidate, he said this wouldn't happen, and then it did happen. So that anger that he's expressing is for real and not entirely misplaced by any means. I mean, certainly public workers are paying more, and I think the municipalities are, if I could be wrong, I think they are paying some toward the pension fund right now. They're not making full contributions. The state, as part of that reform, agreed to gradually make a full contribution. So in the budget year that'll begin this coming weekend, the state will put in a bit over $1 billion, and that'll go up by about $500 million a year for the next 5 years until they're going to be paying $3.5 to $4 billion a year into the pension fund. But yeah, until then, Christie also isn't making that full contribution.
Yeah, and you can hear Rick's anger.
And I can understand that. And if you would go back with me in my column, when this started happening, I kept saying, you've got to stop this because the economy is not always going to be as good as it is today. You've got to make those contributions. And I tell you what, Marty, no legislator, no firemen's union, nobody else came and said, Bob's right. We got to stop this right now. Mm-hmm. They didn't do it.
And there are similar stories in other states as well,
yes.
These underfunded pension programs. Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Murray from Fort Lee has to say. And Murray, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi there.
This is Murray Sabin from Fort Lee. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Murray?
Okay, I just want to speak to Bob and Mike and ask their view on the higher ed merger. I just posted a piece on my website, murraysabrin.com, throwing down the gauntlet to both Republicans and Democrats, that this is probably one of the worst pieces of legislation that I've seen in the state of New Jersey since I moved here in 1977, and it looks like Chris Christie is channeling another Christie Whitman, for her egregious bond issue in 1997, that was supposed to shore up the pension fund, and now the governor is telling the legislators, don't worry, trust me, I will give you the data later, but we got to get this done by July 1st. I understand the vote is tomorrow. So what's your take on this, guys?
Well, and we're talking about the Rutgers-Rowan merger. Yeah, go ahead,
Bob. The Rowan University-Rutgers-Camden merger. Yeah. Well, I've been against it editorially for a whole bunch of reasons. One thing is we don't know how much it's going to cost. And I don't think you should sign off on something that you don't know how much it's going to cost. For another, they're trying to push that through this week, but they've already said it wouldn't take place for a year. So what's the big rush?
Right.
Why do we have to do it now? Now, the people who support this say what they want to do for South Jersey is to build a better higher education system. Okay, there's plenty of promise in that. But I just don't see what the rush is in going about it the way they have. And the people at Rutgers-Camden don't want to be cut off from the main Rutgers campus. They want to remain a part of that institution, which is why the students went there to begin with, because it has an excellent reputation.
Chris Christie, though, is pushing for this.
He is for it, and the other big supporter is George Norcross, the party boss of South Jersey, particularly Camden County.
Marie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Chris from Salem County has to say. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm an educational researcher, and the area in which I work is helping people understand how to take in the world around them, make sense of it, and then respond appropriately. One of my concerns about what the authors have presented about Governor Christie is this lack of understanding of self-regulation. We seek to help children and adults understand how to self-regulate.
Well, Chris, let me just stop you there. Are you talking about his weight?
I'm talking about his entire lifestyle and his leadership and his communication. So this lack of self-regulation, the ability to take in and balance and respond appropriately, is a thread, a theme that goes throughout his life. I think they've missed that theme. And here's the final crux of the issue. When you do that, you have an individual who is a quote, a role model, unquote, for our students, who is not self-regulating either. And when that individual responds to a question from the audience, well, I'm the damn governor, that's not self-regulation, folks. That's someone who is promoting himself and not seeing the greater good.
Okay, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Your thoughts, Bob?
I think one of the things, and I don't know if she's read the book or not, maybe not, or she would know what we've actually said about this. But there is too much PC in the world. There is too much a politician saying what they think they ought to say so that nobody can figure out what it is they've said. They come in with teleprompters and speeches and cards. And then when we in the media get the printed version, we read it. Well, they didn't say a thing. Christie is not like that. That is the way he expresses himself. And that's one of the reasons that he's very popular, because people say, well, if I were governor, that's how I would want to do it, too. He's not PC, and he doesn't claim to be.
Well, and it's a love him or hate him kind kind of governor.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he certainly sets off strong reactions in a lot of people. You know, the way I've described in other interviews is, you know, he is that way often, but he's also not that way. He can kind of turn it on, turn it off. And then he goes and holds a town hall meeting and calls a state senator an arrogant SOB, and then we're off again. But yeah, I mean, he certainly, you know, there is a certain aspect to him of think it, say it, and that turns some people off. But it's also, you know, genuinely part of who he is and who he's been for 49 years.
He has criticized the Democrats in the legislature, calling them Corzine Democrats. Is that a hurtful thing to say in New Jersey, to be called a Corzine Democrat?
I don't know. That's sort of a phrase that they've started in the last week or so. And I don't know how effective that will truly be, because while by the end of Governor Corzine's term, there were people who were eager for a new direction and who didn't necessarily feel a connection with him, I don't think people had like a visceral hatred toward Governor Corzine. I mean, the people were exasperated by the economy. People were worried about the direction of the state. But I don't think that people like in their guts really disliked Governor Corzine. So I don't know how effective that is 2.5 years later.
Bill, you write about this community education center, and this, of course, takes us back to Bill Palatucci,
right.
Who was senior vice president for Community Education Center.
Mm-hmm.
That center has come under some investigation, some concern about these are halfway houses. There's been violence, escapes, assaults. Mm-hmm. Help us understand what's going on here.
Well, that has been going on for some time. Now, most people remember the New York Times article because I think maybe that was last week. Relatively soon. But if you want to go back to last fall, the state controller put out a report, which I think probably is where the New York Times got the idea to do the story and expand on it, but said, you know, there's lax oversight. There's too many people escaping. There's drugs. And then the Asbury Park Press, which is a part of the Gannett, New Jersey operation, had done something maybe 2 years ago about it. So it isn't really new. I guess the question to ask is, since it's been out there, right, why hasn't something been done about it?
Well, why do you think that it hasn't? And does it take us back to his meeting, Governor Christie's relationship with Bill Palatucci?
I find that, having known both of these fellows, for some time, I find it very difficult to think they're okay with people escaping these places and causing harm to other people. I just don't think so. But it's a very good question, a very legitimate question to ask. It's not like we just found out about this. We've known about this for some time. So why hasn't something been done?
What do you think, Michael? Yeah. Then we'll get back to our callers.
Well, and the why hasn't something been done certainly applies to both the executive and the legislative branches of government. I mean, these escapes...
This was known.
Right. These escapes have been going on for a number of years. That doesn't make it right that it's going on now. But... CEC
and escaping
is,
from a halfway house.
It's almost like walking away in a certain sense. But, you know, I mean, there are a lot of political connections here, both to Republicans and to Democrats also. A lot of the company's campaign contributions over the years have actually gone to Democrats.
Oh.
And so that may be part of why there hasn't been a whole lot of ambition to take on the issue in Trenton from either side, because they're pretty plugged in everywhere, Republicans and Democrats.
I mean, this is a privately run company, though. I guess the idea
And that's part of why it becomes a sort of an issue for Christie, because he's been pushing privatization of public services. And while that's something that has gone on in New Jersey a lot, he really emphasizes it. And this can become an example where that seems to have caused some problems.
Let me get Paul from Cherry Hill to join us. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. Hi. How you doing? Thanks
Good.
For taking my call, Marty.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I was just wondering if his relationship with Bruce Springsteen. I know it seems to be volatile, and Bruce seems to always be, you know, not showing up when he asks him to and whatever to do concerts. And I was just wondering if this is as bad as it is, or it's just Christie just trying to get more attention and soaking off Bruce.
Well, you have a whole thing about Springsteen.
There's a big section in the book about Springsteen. The governor is a honest-to-goodness, huge Springsteen fan, maybe the biggest. Now, when it comes to the politics, they're on opposite ends of the spectrum there. But the governor became really incensed when someone had written an article that said that maybe he had gone to sleep during a Springsteen concert.
Yes, and he was very offended.
He was very offended that anyone would even think that. But yeah, he's a real big fan. In fact, a good friend of his told me, you don't ever want to go to a Springsteen concert with the governor, because he knows all the words and he sings along, and he says it's the most horrible experience you can imagine.
There's something, though, I've never quite understood. When you're a fan of a musician whose lyrics are so against what it is that you believe in, it's hard for, and you're not Chris Christie, so I'm not going to ask you to speak for the governor, Michael, but it's a curious disconnect to me.
Right, and a lot of people have pointed that out. Like, are you just listening to the beat and the instruments, or are you also listening to the words along the way? But
yeah
I mean, it's something that goes back years and years for him, but it's sort of interesting, even the fact that Christie asks Springsteen to consider playing Atlantic City on Labor Day weekend, and instead I think he's playing Philadelphia. So
doesn't Springsteen sort of studiously ignore Chris Christie when he's in the audience?
Well, he does. That's what we hear. In fact, Michael had written an article about how some of the governor's, a newspaper article, about how some of the governor's policies affect people.
Yeah.
And Springsteen wrote a letter to the Asbury Park Press, called it a hometown newspaper, about Michael's article, and which is, well, it's good. Somebody is showing that side of it. You know, it's sort of an anti-Christie kind of a letter, which is in the book.
Well, indeed. And has Chris Christie read your book? Do you know, Bob?
He has read it. We gave him the very first copy because I told him early up front, look, when it comes out, you'll get the first copy. We gave it to him. He read it, and I can't remember. It was some kind of event where Michael and I were both there, and he sort of walked by in passing, and he says, oh, by the way, finished your book. I like it.
And that was it.
That was it.
Nothing more than that.
Nothing more than that. But, you know, heck, he read it. He likes it, you know. What can you say?
Exactly. Now, Michael, there is, I guess, this looming deadline. Legislatures across the country are trying to deal with the end of the fiscal year. What do you anticipate in the next couple of days in Trenton?
Well, the legislature has sent Christie the budget already, which is not early, but it's not as late as it had to be.
I think their budget is different from his budget, I'm assuming.
In small ways, yeah. It's the biggest difference is the tax cut being not included and sort of deferred, the money is put aside. But in large measure, not entirely, it follows the governor's revised budget. He proposed a budget in February, revised it in May. In fact, there are Democrats who are upset with the leadership that it doesn't that isn't more different, that it relies on the governor's spending revenue projections, which they're not sure that they trust. The way that the government is set up in New Jersey, the governor essentially certifies what the revenues are going to be. So even if they thought it was going to be something different, he sets the rules of the game by that regard. A year ago, they sent him a budget that was different from his at the last second, and he wound up using the line item veto power that a governor has in New Jersey to eliminate a lot of their changes. He eliminated some of his own original spending. It appeared vengeful and spiteful, and in retrospect, I think he would even say that it was. So by sending it to him early, they hope to avoid that chaos of it, but I think they're still getting some sort of a veto this week.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for driving down here to join us on Radio Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And our guests have been Bob Engel, Michael Simons, that's S-Y-M-O-N-S, and the book is called Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power, and both of them work for Gannett, New Jersey newspapers. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, and the archives. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.